Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today, on September 11th, we review the war that began because of those attacks, Afghanistan. When President Bush announced the plan to begin military action just weeks after 9/11, he described it in limited terms.
These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
But 16 years later, this limited start has turned into an extensive commitment with an enormous human and financial toll. President Trump recently acknowledged that in a speech outlining his approach toward Afghanistan.
I share the American people's frustration. I also share their frustration over a foreign policy that has spent too much time, energy, money, and most importantly, lives, trying to rebuild countries in our own image instead of pursuing our security interests above all other considerations.
Today in The Exchange, assessing Afghanistan, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests in studio. Joseph Kenny is here, a Marine for more than 30 years, serving both in Iraq and Afghanistan, where he was stationed at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. Joe Kenny's also an executive counselor representing District 1. And Counselor Kenny, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Dan Vallone, a West Point graduate who served in the infantry for 6 years, including a tour in Afghanistan where he trained Afghan army and police. Dan currently works for Reaching Higher New Hampshire, a nonpartisan education policy nonprofit. And Dan, welcome back and good to see you too.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Also with us, Wayne Lesperance, Dean of Undergraduates Programs and a professor of political science at New England College. He has for a long time studied American foreign policy. And Wayne, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Laura. Good morning.
And also with us, Ramatullah Aka, case manager for the International Institute of New England, which helps refugees and immigrants settle in the region. 2 years ago, Ramatullah came to the U.S. from Afghanistan on a special visa due to his work in Afghanistan with U.S. and NATO forces. And Ramatullah, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for making the trip.
Good morning, and thanks for having me in this program. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to ask everybody, but you first, Ramatullah, since you were there. You know, we're focusing this hour on U.S. policy in Afghanistan, but as everyone knows, what got the U.S. involved was the September 11th attacks. What went through your mind that day, Ramatullah, when these attacks happened, especially as it pertained to a U.S. response?
Yes. Thanks for the questions. First of all, I would like to express my condolences to the victims' families of the 9/11 and to the all men and women in the service that they sacrificed their lives for the safety and security of the people in Afghanistan and safety and security of the United States. During the 9/11 attack, during the Taliban regime, I was in Afghanistan. I was in school. It was the period that there was a lot of atrocities going on in the country, especially at the end of the Taliban regime, when the Taliban regime cut the ties with all the international communities, and when they finally the Al-Qaeda regime appears more apparently in the city. And there were both sides atrocity going on, not only from the Taliban side, but there were other jihadi territories in the country that we were suffering from. We were split in two parts. Some of my family were living in the center. Some of my family were living in the village areas, which in the village area was the other jihadi groups that they were there, which called Northern Alliances, and the center was the Taliban. So they were both spreading their cruelty on the people, killing people. Like there was a famous saying in my country that everybody knows that currently now, that Taliban first hit the people, beat the people, and then ask the questions. But the other side, the Northern Alliances, asked the question and then beat the people. So there was both the same kind of
things
going
were
on.
Rough, very rough.
Apparently, at the end of the time, like when I was there, like I saw, because I grew up in a situation which was more a country in the war. I never seen another world, a different world. I was all grew up there. Even my father was saying, like, when will be the day that finally we will see a wonderful day? And that in 9/11, when 9/11 happened, when it was like a morning that people were in a bad dream, like a bad dream of 5 years or more than that, and then wake up in a different new morning.
How old were you, Rahmatullah?
I'm 29.
You were 20.
Yes.
You were 29 at the time.
No, I'm 29 now. I was 16 years before. I was almost 17 and 16 years.
Did your family think, okay, you know, this terrible thing happened to the U.S. Partly because of what's going on in our country? Did you think at that time, all right, the U.S. is probably going to come in?
That was not that belief that when 9/11 happened that people will think of that maybe the U.S. will come here. That was only belief that maybe the Taliban regime will collapse, the Northern Alliances will come up, and the people are afraid of again the previous problems that jihadis leaders were fighting with Shia
from the earlier
civil war. Yes,
the earlier regime, the Northern Alliance.
Yes, that was a fear between the people.
Okay. I want to hear from everybody else, too. It's very interesting, though, Rahmatullah, to hear your perspective since you were there. So, Joe Kenny, how about you, given your long service with the Marines? What went through your mind on 9/11, in addition, obviously, to the shock and the horror, about what the U.S. might do?
Well, I was actually on an independent Marine assignment working out of the U.S. Marshals for a counter-drug program. And I remember listening to the TV. I was actually in a cubicle at the Joe Moakley building, and I saw the first plane hit. CNN was on. We always had the TV on. And I looked over to my supervisor, Tony Fasali, a few moments later, and I said, Tony, I think that was a terrorist attack. And he goes, no, that was just a plane that accidentally hit the Trade Tower. And I said, and a few moments later, the second plane hit. And he looked right at me, and he had the, a really frightening look on his face. He says, you're right. And at that point, the world for me and for America changed. You had non-combatants who were in the trade towers, who were in the aircraft, who suddenly their innocent lives were taken away by this hostile group called Al-Qaeda. And so my initial reaction was revenge, anger. We have to reestablish America, and that we're all in it together, and we need to respond as a nation to make sure that we attack the people who attacked us. So that was kind of the American kid that grew up in me that says, I've got a new day, a new responsibility to secure my nation, to help out my country any way that I can. So it's a very solemn day for me when I think of 9/11 and as other Americans. And I get very emotional because we all know people through friends or relatives that lost lives that day. And so I know a couple of people indirectly who were lost on 9/11. And so it's very emotional. And I know that there was a sense of me that says, I've been trained for this moment like other people, and we need to respond, and we're on a heightened alert, and we need to go attack.
Well, and by the way, it's 9:08 now, and I did want to say that at 9:03, so while the exchange was on the air 16 years ago, United Flight 175 crashed into the South Tower. So I just want to respect that that time, 9:03. Wayne L'Esperance, what were you thinking? In addition to your work as a political scientist, you come from a military family. So I wonder what you thought on that day, especially again in terms of, okay, now what is the U.S. going to do?
I do. So I was getting ready that morning to go to teach a class, U.S. foreign policy class, and I remember hearing the first report of the first hit and a lot of the speculation that it was an accident, the sort of what Joe was saying. And, you know, my ears were sort of perked up a bit at that. And I was finishing getting ready when the second plane hit. There was no doubt in my mind that this was coordinated, that we were under attack. And as we began to hear more about other Shanksville, Pennsylvania and the Pentagon, it was clear to me. And so I called. I have a brother that was in the United States Army and a brother in the United States Marine, a brother-in-law that's in the United States Navy. Makes an interesting conversations at Thanksgiving at my house. and my dad is a former Navy SEAL. So I called home and I said, what do you think? And my brother got off the phone because he was being called back to his base. All leaves were being canceled. They were pulling everybody back almost immediately. So others were concluding that we had a very serious event unfolding. The nature of which we weren't really sure how big or how much more there could be. I remember I went to school and we have an area called our Simon Center, which is our big public space, and I had TVs brought in. And as a community, if you can imagine, a lot of college students, many of whom from the greater New York area, were very afraid. So we spent the better part of the day just there talking with them, trying to answer and failing miserably the question why. And I think like a lot of Americans, we wanted to sort this out. Afghanistan was a place that most Americans knew nothing about. My total knowledge about Afghanistan goes back to when the Soviets invaded. That's what I knew from the Cold War history. I knew about Al-Qaeda. I knew about this growing concern about them. But I was fairly convinced after the second hit that we were going to war. What that looked like, how long that would be. I could never have imagined 16 years later we'd be doing another show and still talking about that commitment. That was my experience. I spent most of my day very worried about my brothers and thinking a lot about my students who are all military age and what the future might mean for them.
Sure, and we'll talk about this hour, that when President Bush announced military action, we played that clip in the beginning, it was very limited. We're going to attack terrorist training camps. We're going to go after, you know, the Taliban specifically and Al-Qaeda hideouts specifically. But there was no talk of, you know, nobody imagined, as you said, Wayne, that it would be 16 years.
Or we would eventually get up to 100,000 troops on the ground, or, you know, what the nature of this would actually look like. And really, frankly, how well we were prepared, not just for fighting that fight, but to take care of our men and women after they came home, which is an ongoing conversation. So, yes, I don't know that any of us could have predicted this. Remember, too, two things. Iraq was very much on people's minds about President Bush because Iraq at that point had been in noncompliance with all the post-war sanctions and all that. So folks were focused there. Afghanistan was not really on the radar as a place that we would get involved. And I guess that, you know, that failure of imagination, one of the big criticisms of what happened on September 11th, we didn't imagine this could happen. That's part of that.
Dan Vallone, as I said in the beginning, you're a West Point graduate in the infantry for 6 years. Where were you on 9/11 and what was kind of going through your mind, especially given your military background?
Sure. So I was actually a junior in high school at Epping here in New Hampshire. And I can remember when the first tower was hit, you know, teachers coming in and saying something has happened. Nobody really knew what. And then all of a sudden everyone went to a TV and just watched. And, you know, the rest of the day is this weird memory of people going through motions, trying to, particularly adults, trying to articulate some sort of rationalization and not really knowing what to do. And then I remember distinctly, one of my friends, her dad was and is an architect, and his firm was getting ready to send people to New York because in the aftermath of the attacks, I think a lot of people just started to drive to New York because they thought they could help. It's not dissimilar from what happened with Harvey right now. And she was in tears because she was here. Her dad was about to go into New York City, and no one knew what was going on if there were more attacks coming. And then actually, so the first time I visited West Point was October 2001, and that visit had been planned before 9/11. because I had been interested in going into the military. And then I remember distinctly going on to West Point's, onto the base, and having armed soldiers searching every vehicle. They had M16s out. It was a very
heightened feeling
of security. But what I distinctly remember was that that visit was that we didn't know what we were going to do. I mean, assets were being mobilized. I didn't know that at the time, but Special Operation Forces, the CIA, were moving. But those young cadets at West Point were ready. And they didn't know, we didn't know what was going to happen, what they were going to do, but their sense of duty, sense of mission was so tangible in that atmosphere. That was what, for me, made me know that I wanted to go there. That's what I wanted to do. And I was enormously thankful. I think my family was thankful that we got to see that those young men and women were ready. They were ready to go and do whatever was asked of them, even if at that time we didn't know what that was going to be.
I want to invite our listeners to join us, and then we have so much more to talk about, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, we are assessing the war in Afghanistan. A month after the September 11th attacks, President Bush authorized strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps, military installations of the Taliban regime. Now, 16 years later, we're looking at what has been accomplished, what remains to be done, what the future might hold for the U.S. and its policy in Afghanistan. The number 1-800-892-6477. Again, email exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR. Exchange. And Ramatullah, so fast forward a couple weeks, President Bush goes on the air and says, we're coming in. We're going to do this in a limited way, but we're coming in. What did people in Afghanistan think? Were they happy? Were they worried? What did they think?
Mostly within those couple of weeks, a lot of other incidents happened in Afghanistan, like that they were people were mostly in a dark shadow. Our house was close to the police station that usually Taliban, and there was people that they speak Arabic, there was people that they speak Urdu from Pakistan. They were all based there. So they hanged 40 people from the Northern Alliance side in the squares with the crane because they were surrendered to them, or they say that they believe that they were opposition from the opposition group. They hanged there. They were killed before, and then they were hanged. So we came from the school outside, and then people were just watching around in the squares, and then they had the loudspeakers, the Taliban. They were announcing that they are the infidels, that they are from the other groups, and that's what happened to them. Everybody do the same. It will be happened during the same.
So it's so, basically yes. trying to terrify you into not supporting the Northern Alliance, which is the other
yes.
group, by hanging dead bodies around the
by hanging dead bodies
in the public place.
It was all hanged, in the squares. And the other thing was like those who are from the northern provinces that they had the signboards written like a mechanical work, TV workshop, like no, not TV workshop, but like motorbike workshop
sure.
from Parwan province. So the name of Parwan was there. So they went. They go to the house, they took the people and they put them to Polisherhi. So at that 2-3 weeks, like more than 100 people were imprisoned. They took to the prison because they were from the Northern Alliance provinces. They burned the houses in the district of the Kabul that they took from the Northern Alliances, which are like 20 miles from Kabul. So there were a lot of incidents happened there to fear the people that not to support the Northern Alliances, not to worry about the United States that they will come. So they were trying to show their military. They were trying to prepare their military close to their to the hills and our houses, like we saw there. Because I was in school, I see things there. They were trying, the military tanks were all over there. So they were trying to show the people that we are strong and we can not to fear the people and also to show that, no, we will be here.
So if America comes in, they're trying to show people we're ready. And by the way, don't think about cooperating
yes.
with those Americans,
yes.
which you did, actually. And that's partly why you
yes.
had to come here, which we will talk about in a moment. So much more to cover. And we'd love to hear your reflections, too. On the war in Afghanistan, as Wayne Lesperance said, nobody imagined we'd still be talking about this 16 years later. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
This week, NHPR's Something Wild explores the intertidal zone, that place between high and low tides.
And this is a difficult place to live. Twice a day, you are pounded by waves and then exposed to sun and wind.
Doesn't sound so bad on a warm September afternoon, but imagine that constant barrage in November. Chris and Dave give us the lowdown on the creatures and veg that call this place home. Subscribe to Something Wild wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we are looking back at the war in Afghanistan. 16 years now. The war began shortly after the September 11th attacks, when President Bush authorized what he described at that point limited strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and other military installations. We're looking back at this war, what has been accomplished, what has not. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And just, Wayne, a point of clarification. We've heard a lot from Rahmatullah about, you know, how terrible it was living under the Taliban. He just told us a story about, you know, them hanging bodies, my goodness, just to scare people to not cooperate with the Americans should they come, and the Northern Alliance. And just remind us who those folks were, because the U.S. worked with them when the U.S. first came in.
Right. So if we think about Afghanistan, we can think about a number of competing groups that we're trying to control. And largely we describe them in the United States as sort of regional warlords. And this was a group that the United States sort of hitched its wagon to. That, frankly, there were really no good options in terms of alliances or allies for the United States in the region. But the Northern Alliance was hostile to the Taliban, which suited our purposes. And so we linked up with them. I'm sure that you could speak to it much better than I can, but I think at the end of the day, this was an alliance of convenience more than anything else, in an attempt to try to get the Taliban to turn over Osama bin Laden and the leadership of al-Qaeda. When they refused on October 7th, that's when President Bush decided it was time to go to war.
Well, and as Rahmatullah told us, you know, the Northern Alliance, they were against the Taliban, so we supported them, but they were not, you know, puppies and unicorns and kittens.
Absolutely. I mean, these are not Thomas Jeffersons and George Washingtons, right?
Yeah. And go ahead, Dan Vallone.
Yeah, I just think one other thing that we should also remember is on September 10th, 2001, al-Qaeda killed Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was actually, if there was one leader of the Northern Alliance, that was him. And al-Qaeda did that in part to get the Taliban to protect them, knowing that they were going to attack America the next day. So that made things a whole lot more complicated once we went in and there was no actual single leader who could rally the Northern Alliance like Ahmad Massoud could have.
Well, and very shortly after the September 11th attacks, President Bush gave a speech to the nation saying, you know, this is terrible. Look, Taliban, this is what you need to do. He laid out some conditions. I'm going to play a little bit from his speech on October 7th, 2001. This is President Bush explaining why he had decided to approve military strikes in Afghanistan. He said he'd given the Taliban government a chance to avoid this fate.
More than 2 weeks ago, I gave Taliban leaders a series of clear and specific demands. Close terrorist training camps, hand over leaders of the al-Qaeda network, and return all foreign nationals, including American citizens unjustly detained in your country. None of these demands were met. And now, the Taliban will pay a price.
So, Wayne, was it ever really possible that the Taliban would do those things?
Was it possible? I suppose. Was it realistic that they would? No, not at all. They weren't in a position to do it. They would have invited a response from al-Qaeda against them, so you would have sown some internal conflict there. There really was no option. This was a regime that had gone all in on supporting a terrorist group. And to some extent, there was a relationship with Pakistan sort of sitting across the border, also supporting these guys, which we now know. I don't think we fully appreciated at the time. And so, no, it wasn't realistic that they would suddenly find the president's argument compelling. Remember, at this point, this is a relatively, you know, new president, and they're trying to figure out how serious he was. And he demonstrated that. The other thing we should all remember is that on October 7th, this decision was taken. We often describe the war in Afghanistan as a rush to war. But in those 3-plus weeks in between, there was tremendous pressure and criticism of President Bush for not acting quickly enough, for not being decisive fast enough on doing something about that attack. And there was even criticism on the initial strikes, which were largely cruise missiles over the horizon attacks, that that wasn't big enough. So, you know, history has a way of sort of forgetting those pieces. But in the moment, the president, George W. Bush, who is often seen as somebody who was very aggressive when it came to the military, was considered to have been too light a touch.
Well, so early criticism that President Bush wasn't acting quickly enough or in a big enough manner. I remember Joe Kenney on the other side, and I was, you know, hosting this show at the time, and we did tons and tons of conversations about this. And I remember folks coming in, Joe, and saying the opposite of what Wayne said, which is, you know, just go after the Taliban, I mean, the Al-Qaeda folks. Don't start a full-scale war. We'll be stuck in there forever. It'll cost a lot of American lives, a lot of American money. There'll be, you know, unintended casualties on the Afghan side. Innocent people will be killed. And we've seen that. You know, we've seen weddings being accidentally bombed and stuff. So some folks said, just be targeted, be smart, send in special forces. Don't launch this full-scale operation. Here we are 16 years later. Some of the stuff they said has come true.
Well, from my perspective, much like Wayne said earlier, there's this thing called Iraq that was really at one point drew the attention of the country and the president. And we found ourselves going into Iraq in, you know, 2003 and 4. I myself was deployed in 2005 and 6 right out of the state Senate. And so we lost our focus and attention at one point towards Afghanistan. And it really got directed at Iraq and basically going into Iraq and toppling the regime of Saddam Hussein. And so we really did get somewhat distracted, I think. And, of course, you know, the opposition, if you will, would say that we should have spent more attention and time on Afghanistan. We shouldn't have gone into this war called Iraq. And it was until later, many years later, we said we need to focus our attention on kind of the reconstruction of Afghanistan and making sure that we put a large security footprint there. But it took us a while to get beyond Iraq before we could get back to Afghanistan.
So is that part of the reason you think, Joe, that this thing has spread and gone on for so long, starting with those limited military strikes and ending up in a 16-year engagement?
I think it's prolonged the war in Afghanistan to a certain degree, the going into Iraq and obviously toppling that regime. But I will say this is that, as far as combat operational forces, we stopped that in December of 2014 with ISAF command basically got decommissioned, for lack of words. So we really have been in kind of more in a military advisory assistance role, and we haven't really conducted outright combat since that point in time. So from my perspective, we've always been in Afghanistan to a certain degree. It's just how much are we going to continue to be there, and are we ever going to go back to those 100,000 plus forces on the ground? But remember, when we sent in the PRT teams, the Provincial Reconstruction Teams, the whole purpose of that was reconstruction into these small districts and villages to help out with economic development, security, and to help out with good governance. And the whole idea was to kind of win the minds and wills of the Afghan people so that we could, you know, continue to push out the Taliban and the other terrorist influences in Afghanistan so that the people could now take back their country through the Karzai administration. And so there was a lot of, progress made in that direction. However, once we reduced the security footprint, we found that the Taliban were coming back into the fray of day-to-day life in Afghanistan and disrupting it.
So it requires a larger military presence than we thought because of that. Dan, I want to hear from you, too, on why you think it's been so long. And then, Ramatul, I have another question for you. Go ahead, Dan.
Sure. And, you know, hindsight's 20/20. But I think that there is some alternative universe where if we had captured or killed Osama bin Laden in that initial invasion, things turn out very differently, because we did actually go in with a small light force that was heavily reliant on irregular forces, and they moved quickly to try and destroy the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Osama bin Laden, but he got away into Pakistan, at which point we then had to suddenly own governance in a region that really we didn't have the resources nor did we have necessarily the public support to occupy in the way that we had to because Pakistan was sheltering both the Taliban and Osama bin Laden. As to why, I mean, 16 years, I think that there's a lot of things that we can and hopefully we'll talk about, but I think that once we were forced to kind of convert into some version of nation building, because you have to develop the intelligence sources, you have to start removing the political grievances that gave the Taliban their power in the first place, we never really revisited this. I mean, we're still operating in Afghanistan off of the same authorization for the use of military force that we was authorized in 2001. So we've never really had a conversation as a country, in part because Iraq came up in 2002, 2003, so we switched focus. But we've still never revisited it. And I mean, even in last year's presidential election, how many times did Afghanistan come up? Almost zero. And so as a result, we have just kind of, everyone has done these one-year cycles where the objective was to not lose Afghanistan. And that's a very different approach than trying to go out there and say, what is the actual end state that we need to have as a country? And what is the strategy, military, economic, and diplomatic, that's going to get us to that end point?
So President Obama, a couple years back, I can't remember exactly when, presented his big strategy, the civilian surge and the surge. And, you know, in addition to expanded military presence, there was going to be this, I think it was 8,000 member civilian surge, right? And people were going to go in and, you know, do schools and all the nation building, which is a controversial term. So so there has been some policy attention, and we'll talk in a minute about President Trump's policy that he laid out a couple weeks ago. So there, it's not like people have just kind of bumped along with no guiding document.
So that's true, although even for that deployment, which that was the deployment that I went a part of, we didn't get a new authorization. So no one in Congress was forced to make a vote and take a stand and actually do the kind of consensus building that that forces. But in 2009, that's right. So my unit was actually on the chart to go to Iraq. We did our pre-deployment training on for an Iraq mission. And then in December 2009, President Obama announced the surge. And then a couple weeks later, my unit had their first people on in country doing their recon in Afghanistan. And then we went in and we were part of an effort to train and develop the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police on the institutional side, recognizing that we really need to improve how they train and develop their soldiers, officers, and police officers, because that way they can have a sustainable military and security force. But even then, I think the missing part of that strategy, and every administration every 2 years has talked about this, is what was the attention that we paid to Pakistan, to India, to Iran, to Russia, to China? Because Afghanistan is situated in such a position that you can't resolve issues in Afghanistan with a purely Afghan-focused mission. And we did have the Afghan-Pakistan kind of envoys, but the degree to which they were empowered, and there's a lot of strategic, I think, mistakes that were made in assigning a specific timetable to a withdrawal. And so everyone kind of knew that our presence there was a surge and that it was predicated on a specific timetable.
That's right. And that was one of the criticisms that President Trump had of President Obama's policy, that you shouldn't have specific timetables because then everybody knows what you're up to and there should be some element of surprise and flexibility. And Wayne, I want to go to you, but Ramatoulou to you first. So again, we've been talking about why has it been so long? It started in a limited fashion. What's better today for Afghanistan, Ramatoulou, since this all started?
Okay.
And well, I know that's not an easy question
yes,
to answer.
Since I grew up in the war, and after the coming to the United States to Afghanistan, I was in school, and then I started my college duration from that time, and then my career on that time. So I have seen much growth and development in the country, which never was happened in the country in Afghanistan. First of all, the country has a Senate, as country has a House of Representative, which was not in history before. Country had a committee that they review the constitution law in Afghanistan, which never happened in the country. The country had president three times, four times election happened in the country, and now the second time election happened in the country without transferring the power by force. The power was transferred through the election and people participated, whether all the elements of the the corruption that was to be considered or not, but still everything happened through a very smart process. Second, thousands of people have went outside and graduated in the colleges, universities. People, females, the rights of the females are now going to be equal in the country. in some way, there's still lack, but that's something that never happened. And people are really, all the people of Afghanistan understand, and they know that the development that happened during the 16 years from the coming of the United States in the country.
So the status of women is definitely better than it was 16 years ago.
People, women have the voice now. Now women are in the House of Representatives that never happened in the history of the country. Women are in the media, like more than 30 televisions, media have been established in the country that never happened in the country. That's a huge progress in the country, and that's what it's understandable for all the people of the Afghanistan, and it's very visible. Still, there are some elements that still is lacking of the because of the corruption, but the improvement is very huge.
So, at the beginning of the show, you gave your gratitude to Americans.
Yes.
For helping your country out, and there's some examples right there. It's interesting to hear that, Wayne, because so much of what we hear is, you know, Afghanistan's not worth it, it's a mess, they'll never be like us, why are we bothering, nation building, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a really great point. I mean, I looked at some of this data last night. In 2002, there were 900,000 boys going to school in Afghanistan. In 2016, there were 8 million children in school, a third of them are girls. That's a huge change in a relatively short time. The issue of the parliament, which I found very amusing, 27% of the parliament is women, which I very quickly went and said, gee, what do we have in the United States? 19%. So they are leading the way in Afghanistan. And life expectancy went from 44 to 60. 16-year increase in life expectancy is nothing to sneeze at. So there are real, tangible benefits that we can point to that are a result of American involvement. At the end of the day, when we're going to talk about Donald Trump's plan, I'm sure in a few minutes, the central question that Americans have to ask is, under what conditions do we win? Under what conditions can we say we have achieved the success we wanted to achieve, the Americans who are deployed can come home? And I don't know that we have an answer. The surge that you described in 2009 never answered that question, right? And so your word, bumping along, is exactly right. Barack Obama ran against those wars. He wanted to bring troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan. And as he became president and became, I think, a little more informed about the conditions in Afghanistan, he came to the conclusion that we needed a significant surge, at initially 68,000 troops, and got us up to our highest deployment point at 100,000. That's sort of the same piece that Donald Trump is facing. So when Trump talks about his plan, it's a recognition that there's work to be done, that the adversaries to peace and prosperity in Afghanistan are on the rise, that ISIS is becoming a new force along the Pakistani border, al-Qaeda and the Taliban are reconstituting themselves in a way that's significant. And what do we do? What do we do about those little girls that are suddenly allowed to go to school if we walk away? I mean, this is a really difficult place the United States finds itself. This is not a partisan thing. It is about what is America's role in the world, in this particular part of the world, and under what conditions can we declare victory in a meaningful way and come home?
Joe, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add, my time frame was 2009 to 2010, working out of the U.S. Embassy. So all this wonderful discussion that Rahmatullah has mentioned about the progress in Afghanistan, we have to give a lot of credit to the the international nonprofit groups, to USAID, to all the folks that are working on bringing education to women, providing midwifery programs so that women could deliver babies, talking about health care, better health care within the hospital systems. But there was so much that was going on the ground, but it was all because of that security footprint. You provided that excellent security footprint, you could develop all these wonderful programs in the districts, in the villages, but once you lose that sense of security, we might be going backwards in the future.
So that surge that President Obama called for, lots of military to support these civilian efforts, it was a good idea, Joe.
Absolutely.
All right. Dan, I know you have some work to talk about there. And then we're going to transition and talk about what President Trump wants to do and how you all feel about it. So all that plus your questions and comments. So stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today on 9/11, we're looking at the U.S. war in Afghanistan, 16 years after the attacks of September 11th, and a few weeks later, the war in Afghanistan began in a limited way. We're looking at what's happened since and what the future may hold. We'd love to hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And all of you, just before the break, Ramatullah Aka was talking about some of the good things that have happened for his country in the 16 years the U.S. has been there. And we talked especially about the status of women. And Dan Vallone, I know when you were in Afghanistan, you worked with women.
Yes, no. So my unit had the privilege of supporting and providing security for the first graduation of the first cohort of women into the Afghan Army Officer Corps. And so this was, again, the first time in this nation's history, first time in a lot of ways for the region to have such a moment happen. And it was incredible to see because not only were these women incredibly brave, going to do something that was very dangerous and going into pilot positions and very on the front lines, but also it was emblematic of the ways in which women in Afghanistan have already changed the country for the better and are going to continue to just transform that country in ways that we can't anticipate or even appreciate. But that's what happens when you empower people and give them the rights that they were entitled to. And I think it speaks to something that Wayne was talking about a little earlier, where we need to have a conversation about a country that connects to, like, what are the values that we are willing to fight for in Afghanistan? And listening to what President Trump said when he said we've been trying too long to rebuild a nation in our own image instead of pursuing our own self-interest, I think that's a false dichotomy. I don't think that our self-interest is disconnected from the ways in which our values are experienced and expressed across the country. And so that doesn't mean that we need to occupy or have a military-first strategy across the country, across the world. But if we're not standing up for values that we believe are universal around the freedom of expression, around freedom of faith, around freedom to vote and to shape your own political environment, I think that we are making ourselves weak, and we see that play out across, whether it's Yemen and Saudi Arabia. We can go country by country, but Afghanistan exemplifies the ways in which when you see when you have a values-oriented mission, we can lead to security improvements both for that country and for America as well.
Well, and yet, and you all know better than I do, people in this country are just tired of it. It's been a long time. A lot of people have died. There's been a lot of money spent. And President Trump, in outlining his strategy in late August, you know, recognized that people have this fatigue. He said America will support the new Afghan government, but not dictate what it should look like. Let's hear.
Ultimately, it is up to the people of Afghanistan to take ownership of their future, to govern their society, and to achieve an everlasting peace. We are a partner and a friend, but we will not dictate to the Afghan people how to live or how to govern their own complex society. We are not nation building again. We are killing terrorists.
So again, that's President Trump in August. One of the things he said leading into that clip that we just played also was there may be a time when the Taliban might be part of a political settlement. Who knows? The president said. Ramatullah, how does that strike your ears? We're not nation building. We're killing terrorists. We support you, but we're not going to tell you how to manage it.
Yes. Well, first of all, the support of the United States is countless to Afghanistan, which is very appreciative to all the Afghans. Second, United States spent a lot of resources to the country. And one of the reasons that why corruption happened in the country was the power with the jihadi leaders. Because when first the government established all those jihadi leaders that academically they were not that much improved of understanding how to build the country, and then there were much people that they were not able to support them, the jihadi leaders. So that was the reason. But from the other hand, now this is a lucky chance for the Afghans, for my country, that use this chance to resolve those political problems that they have between others, and use this chance and to start building their country.
So, sorry to interrupt. So, by this chance, you mean Americans coming in and working with you in terms of judicial systems and political systems? That's an opportunity. It's not America sort of stuffing its values down your throat.
Currently, with the new strategy that has been announced, America is going to stay there to support effort to focus on the main target, which is to eradicate the roots of the terrorists, which now has been cleared that how and where are the roots so that they can eradicate those roots. But still, this will support the security of the country, and this is now the chance for the Afghanistans, like for my country, to use their own potential and then to use the resources that they have on hand as a good chance and rebuild the country.
So in general, did you think that President Trump's strategy was a good one for your country?
Well, a president's strategy, one thing that is really good for my country is the being of the United States in the country, which that's what people of Afghanistan
just being
accept.
There.
Being there is acceptable for the Afghanistan, not leaving the country alone because there are still insurgents there that they can disrupt the country's condition.
That's interesting. Important. Yeah, because often we hear about another sentiment. I know everybody wants to jump in, which is, you know, U.S. get out, stop messing with us. Joe, go ahead, you first.
Well, I just want to let Ramatula just let him know that it's not necessary in a United States sole kind of responsibility to help out Afghanistan. It's got to be an international, you know, support system, much like we did with the creation of ISAF headquarters when we had over 40 nations that were helping out with the security footprint
of
Afghanistan.
So let's not forget about NATO.
They have a very critical role in this. Also, let's talk about economics. A lot of the money that was being made was being run through the poppy fields of Afghanistan. And we have to come up with substitute economy, whether it's pomegranates, agricultural minerals, or whatever it is that Afghanistan can produce. Because if those tribal elders cannot provide for their tribes, and there are literally dozens and dozens of different tribal groups throughout Afghanistan, then they're going to go right back to what they always know, which is the AK-47, in running opium throughout the world. So we have to, Afghanistan, when it comes to self-determination, has to create an economy in which they can live on. So therefore, those young males will have opportunity to help out their tribes and to be able to provide for their families and for a security situation.
So what does that mean in terms of your feelings about President Trump's strong statement that, you know, look, we're not nation building again, we're killing terrorists. That's our goal.
I think from this standpoint, it's not a bad strategy. Remember what happened in the 1980s, the creation of Osama bin Laden. We had turned, America had turned its back on Afghanistan. They forgot about Afghanistan after the 80s. Hence comes the rise of al-Qaeda. And basically, it was a 9/11 was a big slap in our face to say, hey, you forgot about us. And you know what? This could happen again if we don't keep ourselves involved diplomatically and to some degree economically and from a security standpoint in Afghanistan.
Well, and by the way, again, looking at the time at 9:03 when the exchange was on the air, the second plane hit the South Tower at 9:43. So about 5 minutes ago, American Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon. So I just wanted to be respectful of that, that time. Dan, go ahead. I know you have a ton of thoughts about, you know, the importance of rebuilding an economy and the institutions of government.
Sure. And I think that I have concerns about President Trump's plan kind of on two levels. So first, just looking at his plan for Afghanistan and acknowledging that he hasn't disclosed a lot of details that are actually really important. But I think that it perpetuates a problem where we set unrealistic expectations. I don't think there's the case has not been made, at least in my opinion, that we do need to actually be that involved in Afghanistan's economy. When we think about the threats in Afghanistan, again, we go back to what George W. Bush said. Our kind of penultimate concern is about the safety and security of American interests and that of our allies. And the kind of the insurgent networks in Afghanistan, many are focused only on Afghanistan and Pakistan. They're not actually interested in attacking America or our allies. And so I think that there is an argument to be made for a more narrow focus on those insurgent groups that do have the capabilities and the interest in attacking America. On the second level, my concern with President Trump is that he doesn't situate Afghanistan in any part of as part of a larger struggle, which is what it is. I mean, we are engaged in a global effort against kind of anti-American or the rise of authoritarianism. And if we don't have that conversation about this is perhaps the most important, but it is one of many conflicts that we are waging as a country. We have soldiers in Syria. We have soldiers in Iraq. We have soldiers doing missions in Somalia, in Yemen, in Indonesia, in the Philippines. If we don't have that conversation, how are we ever going to sustain the public support? And how are we going to ever improve our ability to engage in more than military measures? Because I think we have consistently, I mean, there's a book that was written by a Georgetown professor, how, you know, everything became war and the military became everything. That is the situation that we find ourselves in because we perpetuate a mission set that relies entirely upon our military assets. And the public fatigue that we talked about earlier, I think that a lot of that stems from that recognition that people don't feel engaged. No one is asking the broad public to actually become involved. What might it look like if we actually turned to the American people and said, we need to reinvigorate our diplomatic corps. We need to surge everyone into the Voice of America that we used to use in the Cold War. We need people in the Peace Corps, in the diplomatic corps, in the intelligence corps. I mean, Americans step up when asked, and we just have consistently not asked them.
So it sounds like you and Joe both support a more robust engagement in Afghanistan, not just on the military level, but on the, if I could put it, civilian level as well.
I think I would say I support a much more robust engagement in the region. I actually think in Afghanistan specific, again, our expectations are too high. I mean, President Trump said used the word win about a dozen times in his speech when he talked about Afghanistan. I think, again, what does that look like? There's never going to be a moment when we take a town, put up the American flag and say we're done. That is just not going to happen. Instead, I mean, I think arguably we need to have a conditioned expectation that is specific to what is needed to protect American interests and the interests of our allies. And that's a regional approach that we need to take in terms of pushing more of our civilian and economic assets there.
So let's put that on our professor. What is win? And it's disheartening to hear you say that, Dan, that there isn't really a win.
Well, just to note real quickly, I would make the case that we won, as we conventionally use that term, in May of 2011 when we killed Osama bin Laden. Al-Qaeda had been destroyed in all its capabilities to conduct international strikes, had been significantly degraded to the point that they were no longer a functional international terrorist organization. We killed Osama bin Laden. That is the win that I think that we understood as a nation. But because we had had these false expectations, suddenly winning meant that we needed to have a stable and stable government in Afghanistan that's free of corruption. That is a wonderful thing, and I have many friends in Afghanistan, and I worked actually with the special immigrant visa that brought Rahmatullah here, and the sacrifice that the Afghans made doesn't get talked about enough because hundreds of thousands have given their lives. But conditioning our expectations towards a stable and corrupt-free Afghan government is not something that I think we have ever dedicated the resources to achieve that, nor do I think it is actually necessary to achieve the American security that was the reason we went in there.
Well, and we see ISIS and everything kind of gets conflated, and we see attacks in Europe and in this country, and so it's hard to see a win or some of the good things that Rahmatullah talked about. Go ahead, Wayne.
So I would agree with what you've heard here. Winning is the defeat, the killing of Osama bin Laden. Winning is the stories about little girls being able to go to school, women serving in the parliament, 120-plus women that are judges, the 20% of college students in Afghanistan that are women. That's winning every single day. But those wins are easily lost. Those wins are easily given away. And that's, for me, the problem with the president's plan. We can kill terrorists all day long, but if we do not eradicate the conditions that lead people to believe that strapping a bomb to their body or picking up a rifle in support of some twisted view of the world is appropriate, then we will find losing again. So sending maybe 5,000 troops to Afghanistan to join the other 8,500 Americans that are there, the
8,500, that's it?
The 8,500 Americans that are there, 13,000 total NATO troops. All they're supposed to be doing there is providing assistance. This is not an army that's there to fight a war, to provide security, as Joe referred to, so that assistance can happen. We have to caretake these very nascent institutions that were created in Afghanistan. That's the American mission, as far as I'm concerned. The president sees it very differently. And I suspect that if we just do the things that he's talking about, killing terrorists, dropping MOABs on caves or on mountains, we'll kill a bunch of bad guys, but there will be new bad guys that follow. The swamp will not be drained, and you will see the conditions that led to the formation of groups like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, come. We'll call them something different, I'm sure, but they will reemerge. So nation building has a very negative connotation. I get that, but it's what's necessary to prevent the rise of groups like these who eventually, at the end of the day, do mean us harm in the world. And so I think until we come to terms with that, we have a problem. Now, on the other side of that, we've spent over $1 trillion in Afghanistan, right? I welcomed a class of freshmen to New England College who were 2 years old when 9/11 happened. This means nothing to them the way it does to us, right? They're far too young. So back to Dan's point, we as Americans have an obligation to have a conversation about what America's role in the world is, what America's values are, and where we are willing to fight for those values, or we're lost. Thomas Jefferson argued, and this is totally impractical, but I love it, that every time we make a decision to go to war, they ought to calculate what the cost is per citizen and hand them the bill. We would take very seriously decisions about going to war if that was really how we managed.
But nobody knows.
Things.
As you said at the outset, Wayne, you know, President
not
Bush launched these limited strikes, and here we are 16 years later.
Not only do they not know, but it's easy for us not to really care. As Dan said, the American people haven't been asked to give up very much. Right. If you have a family member or if you served, and thank you for your service in the military, you know in a very real way what that service means.
Well, and lastly, excellent point, Dan, on the sacrifices of the Afghan people. And Ramatullah, very quickly, you're here on a special visa. Dan worked on that program because you helped out the U.S. and NATO forces and because it wasn't safe, given that role, to stay in Afghanistan. Is that? That's correct?
Yeah, yes, correct. Excuse me. And this is correct. Like, I have traveled to different provinces and never believing that maybe someday you'll migrate to outside, you'll migrate to another country, start a new life. I was trained in the country. I received the benefit from the country. I started a career in the country. I started transferring those training to back to other people. I went to provinces. But later on, the incident happened, concerning my villages, people were thinking maybe, okay, you're even asking my father, oh, what's your son doing? Your son is working with the government. Your son is helping the United States, because there was some insurgent group that they were against you. They were operating hidingly, and they were trying to give you problems and maybe trying to kill you.
So for the safety of your family and yourself,
and myself,
you had to leave.
Yeah, I had to leave, yes.
Okay, so we're really near the end of the hour. Are you here for the long term? Do you know? Are you going to go back? I mean...
Yes, yeah, I'm here for the long term.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hope that we get a chance to talk again with you and with everybody here. This has been super interesting, and I really appreciate everybody's comments.
And I also like to... I would like to mention that now Afghanistan is going through a very grief story this week, because they lost a very precious woman, Nancy Dupree, who served 50 years of his life in Afghanistan, and she died, passed away in Afghanistan, and she trained many Afghans, many people, and has done a lot of services to the Afghan people.
Okay. Everyone, thank you very much for being here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.